Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And so today we're going to be talking about the concept of digital persecution. This is all building off a piece of journalism, a feature I wrote for Christianity Magazine. I'll pop a link in the description to have a read of that. But it's something I've not really thought about before when I was commissioned to look into this whole issue of how is the kind of technological revolution that we've been living through over the past decades, how is that affecting the specific example of the persecuted church, and how are kind of oppressive regimes and others who want to harm, control, suppress, coerce Christians around the world, how are they using some of our everyday technological tools to do so? And it was a really fascinating but quite an alarming kind of deep dive as I read some research and spoke to some people who've been working in this field to understand actually that in many ways the kind of world of persecution has really been revolutionized almost beyond recognition in recent years.
Yeah, that's really interesting, isn't it? Because, of course, persecution and monitoring is not at all new, and you can trace it all the way back thousands of years to human informers. It was reading between the lines in the early church. It was an issue that there were informers and double agents and so on within the local church, and particularly at the time of the great persecutions. But then a sort of electronic surveillance came in, and certainly at the time of the communists in Russia and Eastern Europe, it was very much a kind of electronic. It was all about microphones, hidden microphones, and people with headphones on listening, monitoring, recording conversations. And there were lots of stories then about that kind of amazingly invasive monitoring. But once the smartphone starts, and also things like facial recognition cameras and all the rest, it sort of moves into a new era, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Clearly, you know, people have been using technology of the day to persecute Christians, as they have been doing with everything else for many centuries. But I think what I realized when I was looking into this issue was that it's not just giving a fresh set of tools to the same people who have been trying to persecute Christians, but it enables new forms of persecution because the power of the internet, of artificial intelligence, of the smartphone, of the microchip is so far outstrips, you know, even what we're used to in the 20th century of, you know, analog microphones and radio. So it's really has a kind of totalizing effect on persecuted Christians in many areas in a way that previous bouts of persecution haven't been quite so overtly kind of suffocating.
Yeah, and clearly social media gives someone the possibility of spreading rumors or disinformation about Christians, and that's something you've come across, hasn't it?
Yeah, so one of the interesting angles in this is that a lot of digital persecution, as we'll talk about later, is emanates from states, from governments, but there's also lots of places in the world where non-state actors, where kind of individuals and groups want to persecute Christians, and something that social media in particular, it has this amplifying effect. Whereas, you know, the example that I was given was of in parts of India, there's a real problem with Hindu nationalist extremists who kind of hate Christians and see them as kind of, you know, trying to forcibly convert Hindus away from their faith and kind of representing this colonial outsider Western religion. And there's a real conflation between Indianness and Hinduism. And so a kind of Christian Indian is this contradiction in terms that must be expelled. And, you know, at times that there's very traditional persecution that, you know, they might go and try and burn down the house of a Christian or you know, attack them in the street. But increasingly what people working in this sphere are seeing is the use of social media to kind of whip up angry mobs. And so you might have in one village only a small number of people who are kind of committed to this. It's called Hindutva, this kind of very nationalistic, extremist, chauvinistic kind of brand of Hinduism, who want to kind of force the Christians out, but they, by themselves, they're not big enough to cause a real threat. But actually, by the power of kind of sending malicious rumors around on WhatsApp groups or on Facebook, and when the kind of, you know, virality algorithms get their teeth into that and it starts spinning around and getting passed from person to person, in many ways, it can whip up a mob of people who might otherwise not be interested in Hindutva ideology and haven't previously got any animus towards Christians, but they believe, you know, there's one famous case where some people died in one village because the water supply became contaminated, and the local kind of Hindutva extremists said that this was because a Christian family living in the village had cursed the water. And a mob of people, you know, 100 strong, vastly larger than the people who started the rumors, got so enraged by what they were reading on their phones and came to believe it must be true because it was being forwarded to them so many times, they ended up lynching this family and killing them.
Yeah, and it is deeply disturbing, isn't it? And it's a sort of, just to step back a bit about social media, I think it's such an interesting and painful parable, because if you go back all the way back to Mark Zuckerberg and the origins of Facebook, you know, we've talked about this before, I think, but Zuckerberg comes out of a kind of Silicon Valley, cool, slightly sort of hippie, information wants to be free, you know, make everything free, make everything open, you know, what can possibly go wrong? And so he says, I want to connect every single human being on the planet with Facebook. You know, what can possibly go wrong? And yet, just that sort of naive idea that once you connect everything, it's all going to be peace, truth, love, and harmony. And then lo and behold, it's like this kind of emergent property that out of just connecting human beings, rather than there being peace, truth, and love, there comes a kind of outpouring of anger, hate, and people die and terrible things happen simply by connecting human beings. And interestingly, part of the problem with the technology giants who come out of this techno-optimistic mindset is they don't have a category for evil. Whereas, you know, from a Christian point of view, it's not the slightest bit surprising. You know, if we understand the concept of the fall and what Jesus says about the evil of the human heart, and out of the human heart comes all these terrible things, we're not that surprised if you connect human beings together. Some terrible things can happen.
Yeah, absolutely. It's that well understood kind of phenomenon of the power of the mob, where you gather together 100 people and somehow as a kind of amorphous organism, they're able to perpetrating terrible things that none of these 100 individuals would do or even wish to do by themselves. It's that multiplied by millions, tens of millions online, and you get these online mobs that are tragically can have real world consequences. You know, the most infamous would be actually didn't target Christians, but Muslims, Rohingya Muslims living as one of the minorities in Burma and Myanmar, who many outside advisors that have really been suffering a genocide, in large part being whipped up online on Facebook by, again, in this instance, kind of Buddhist nationalist Burmese mobs, aided and abetted by the army.
So I was just going to say, it was interesting that the way that Silicon Valley has now tried to adjust to this reality is that it now thinks that most people are fine and really nice, and then there's a few people and they're the bad actors. And bad actors are the problem. And what we've got to try and do is identify the bad actors and stop them. And provided we can block them and get rid of bad actors, everything's going to be fine. And I'm afraid, again, this is just a naive perspective, because the reality of it is that all of us are potentially bad actors. All of us have this potential within us. And so in order to, how you prevent that coming out, I think is a real challenge, isn't it?
Yeah.
One of the things that is being suggested, and I think is absolutely right, and that is that we have to have really robust identification so that everybody who enters social media, their identity is immediately obvious to everybody, and that it is illegal and there is strong control to have anybody pretending to be someone else or hiding behind a false identity or using bots or whatever, that one of the things is that we have to be able to identify who everyone is in social media. And I think that in itself would be a very, would restrict evil. It wouldn't stop it, but it would restrict it.
There's a lot of merit to that idea. I'll just briefly note the irony is that some of the people we're talking about, the victims here, are people who would suffer from that as well, because in many parts of the world, you cannot be open and public under your real name if you're a pastor or a Christian. And, you know, when this idea is floated, I know that there are lots of human rights groups, not just Christian religious liberty groups, but human rights groups in general, who say that this actually would have disastrous consequences and would be welcomed by some repressive regimes, because it gives them an even greater ability to control and to stamp out kind of dissident illicit speech on social media, because people can only currently be free to talk about that because they know that it can't be traced back to them and their real lives. So these things are very, there's no obvious policy solution. They're very, very complicated. So as well as the kind of social media dilemma, which, you know, comes up almost every episode, it feels like, of this podcast, the other thing that really was interesting and concerning looking into this was actually about slightly more, less kind of everyday technology, or even everyday technology that's been used for quite oppressive ways, often by, not by groups, but by states, by governments. Which has the effect, I think, of both, the two kind of sides of the coin are both censorship and surveillance. And in surveillance, it was hard to ignore the fact that a lot of the threads seem to lead back to China as this kind of technological superpower, which is pioneering not only in software, but also hardware. But at the same time, all this software and hardware is being produced by a deeply repressive state, which under the Communist Party has tried to kind of suppress, control, at times even eliminate the church within its borders. And so this surveillance state effectively has arisen in China, which is increasingly the fire of that has been turned on the church, and particularly those Christians who don't worship in the kind of official, complicit, state-controlled propaganda Protestant church, which is a massive, massive, massive issue.
I think it is. And unfortunately, what you got in China is you got this combination of an increasingly oppressive totalitarian regime and President Xi, coupled with cutting edge science and artificial intelligence and technology and so on. And it's a really interesting and challenging kind of a problem, I think, because during the pandemic, China, for its own purposes, decided to massively ramp up its surveillance on its entire population. And apparently what happened during the pandemic is that they had been developing very particular techniques for the Rohingya Muslims.
Uyghur Muslims in this case, actually.
Sorry, Uyghur, you're quite right.
A different persecuted Muslim minority.
You're quite right, the Uyghurs. They'd been developing this technology there, and that when the pandemic came, effectively what they then did is rolled out very similar techniques across the entire population, and in particular using facial recognition, but also the smartphone as a source of of monitoring. And also what was particularly troubling was apparently they were also, for the Uyghurs, they were collecting DNA and matching up the DNA with the facial recognition, with the smartphone, you know, all intended to be able to maximize the degree of social control. And so, I think there's no doubt that we're now in a new era where we have to accept that the levels of surveillance that are possible are extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, there's one academic I spoke to who kind of studies some of this wave of digital persecution, and he kind of noted that, you know, if an oppressive regime, let's say China, wanted to know what was happening inside one particular church, they would previously, they'd have to either, you know, coerce or recruit kind of informers to go into the congregation and spend lots of time kind of following the pastor around on foot. Whereas now they can just use the publicly accessible CCTV cameras outside and facial recognition software to know automatically every single person who walks inside the building. They could hack into the live stream that the church is doing and so know exactly what's being said inside. And then you can just track the pastor by the fact that his car is now effectively also a bug, because modern cars all connect to the internet. And so they can be tailed remotely without having to fuss around with kind of, you know, Mission Impossible style physical bugs. You can just figure out its IP address and hack into the network. And as it's talking to all the various, you know, 3G, 4G cell towers, you know exactly where it is. And sometimes you could even hack into its microphone built in and find out what someone is talking about inside the car. And so it's given this kind of panopticon, totalizing 360 degree view, which would previously been very, very costly with man hours and resources, and also only ever be partial before.
Yeah, and it's really hard to know, you know, where this is all going, isn't it? I mean, again, we've talked about it before, and part of me feels that the traditional concept of privacy has now become almost meaningless, in that it is simply not possible to be a completely private individual where nobody knows where you are, nobody knows what you're doing, nobody knows who you're meeting. What I think, and of course it would be wrong to say this is only happening in China, because we know that this is happening across the world in many Western states as well. The difference is that in Western states, that there is at least some control over how the data is all being used. Data is available and is accessible to the intelligence services. The theory is that that is under some kind of democratic control, and that that data is only being analysed and used where there is a specific need for terrorism, national security, and so on.
Yeah. And we saw with the, you know, if you remember the kind of Snowden leaks about the American NSA, that security services are, both in Western democratic countries, in this case, as they are in China, have a kind of insatiable demand for data. You know, data is being produced in the trillions of pieces on a daily basis by people on their phones, on the internet, and the security services are just gobbling up as much of this as possible. And it emerged from these leaks by the whistleblower that was happening with the NSA and GCHQ. And of course, their motives were purer in that they were trying to, you know, analyze this data to find people who were plotting terrorist attacks or whatever. But the same fundamental process is it's once this fire hose, once you realize that people are generating this fire hose of information about themselves every time they interact with a digital device, it's almost impossible for intelligence services, whether from China or from the West, to resist the urge to suck it all up on a server somewhere just in case you might need it at some point, which raises the kind of specter of, at the moment, we're pretty confident that unlike in China, this is not being used to track when I go to church or what Bible apps I'm reading online or what my WhatsApps are saying. But that capability exists, and should the status of Christianity in the West shift over my lifetime, who knows what will happen.
Well, and I think that's right. You know, we know that it's perfectly possible for quite extreme governments to be voted in into democratic societies. And if, for whatever reason, 10 years down the line, an extreme government is voted in here in the UK, and that regarded that evangelical Christians as a fundamental threat to their political continuation and so on, how confident are we that our British systems will resist that? And so I think these are, you know, these are huge issues which we're all faced. And certainly when one thinks, I mean, we know that there are many, many Christians in China and in these other totalitarian regimes who are somehow having to negotiate these extremely complex issues.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, the other side we haven't touched on yet is the one thing, one side is that digital technology allows surveillance, as we've discussed, to be ramped up enormously. You know, we haven't even touched on the idea of, you know, installing spyware surreptitiously on a smartphone, which basically turns it into a bug, and you can turn on the microphones or the camera remotely, read all the messages, even in encrypted apps, all that thing. But there's also the censorship. So again, to use a Chinese example, in recent years, there's been a kind of ramping up of an enforcing of laws which kind of ban the dissemination of information about Christianity online. And so, you know, there've been algorithms sent which kind of automatically scan through, you know, online bookstores, the Chinese version of Kindle or Audible or anything like that. And anything that includes kind of banned characters, which include like Jesus or Christian, are just automatically removed and censored. And then even more so, they have AI kind of driven programs that scan the whole open internet and look on social media and on blogs, on anything. And again, when they find suspicious or banned words, it raises a red flag. And so if you're a Chinese Christian and you want to, you do something as banal as kind of share the details of your next prayer meeting online, you have to start speaking in code, because you can't say words like "let's go and pray" or "we'll be reading from the book of Ephesians," because that's going to trigger some alarm. And it doesn't need, as you know, in the olden days of the kind of totalitarian regime of the 20th century, you know, huge warehouses of people listening into bugged telephones. This is all happening at very low cost automatically by software. And so it creates, again, a much more totalizing effect. There's even been reports of people speaking live on China's equivalent of Zoom, doing kind of church meetings or Bible meetings. And suddenly the Zoom is cut off because someone used one of these banned words. And even on a live audio feed, the software can recognize it and intervene to kind of stop it. So it really has this chilling effect, because you're like, hang on, I don't just have to worry if I'm talking to a human being in person, are they an informer? But it's like any time I interact and express my faith online, I might be come up against this kind of panopticon of censorship.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was just thinking, this, of course, using code words, again, is nothing new.
No.
And that, again, my experience of persecuted Christians in the time of the communist era in Europe, there was an elaborate set of code words that were used because the assumption was that the communists were listening to every conversation. And therefore, Christians agreed avoiding using particular terms. And I was just thinking, there is the speculation that even in the New Testament, in one place in Paul's letters, that he's using a recognized code. And that is, it's in Philippians, where he talks about Epaphroditus, who he's been longing to see you and has been distressed because you heard that he was ill. Indeed, he was ill, near to death, but God had mercy on him. And then he says later, receive him in the Lord with all joy and honor such men, for he nearly died for the work of Christ, risking his life to complete what was lacking in your service to me. So whatever this mysterious illness was, he nearly died for the service of Christ. And it's been suggested that actually that was a code word that the when people were being tortured, it was actually a code. And they said, "Oh, he's been very ill."
Yeah, as you say, not a new idea, not a new concept, but I think the digital technology is kind of allowing it to infiltrate more and more areas of life.
There was another technique you mentioned in your article, which I thought was very interesting, about the police taking somebody into the police station and then getting them to make a call to someone outside the country.
That's a really chilling one, isn't it? That was kind of pioneered again in Xinjiang against the Uyghurs, where there is a large number of kind of Uyghurs who have gone into exile as a result of the persecution, including some kind of prominent religious leaders who are campaigning and campaigning against the Chinese kind of repression there. And the favoured solution by local officials is to send some police officers to go and pick up the mother or the family or the children of this exile, bring them to a police station, and then insist that the relatives start a video call, a WhatsApp call probably, or some kind of video chat call with their relative, and they're in Germany or America or whatever, somewhere safe, and they see a call coming in from their mum, a video call. They probably do this regularly. They're like, oh, great, right. They open up that. And then suddenly on the video screen, what they see is not their mum, but they see a police officer in the foreground. In the background is the mum and the family sitting there looking scared. And the police officer very sternly informs them that, you know, you need to come back to China in person, get on a flight tomorrow and fly to China right now, you know, or else ... And they leave it very, you know, very unsubtle about what the consequences of them not kind of voluntarily repatriating themselves, which apparently is an incredibly effective kind of form of coercion, and really has helped China kind of its tentacles reach beyond the borders of China itself and either stop or kind of repatriate troublesome individuals. I think the other thing that's worth mentioning is that we've been talking a lot about China, and one, as you mentioned, this is not unique to China. A lot of these capabilities exist in the West, even if they're not currently being used in such an oppressive way towards Christians. But actually, it goes a lot further than just China as well, because there are dozens and dozens of countries around the world which have bought into this technology from China, that have installed CCTV cameras or these software or these AI programs into their own internet networks, so that they can repress, monitor, coerce, surveil, censor. And sometimes, in some cases, there are reports that some of these countries are sending their officials back to China to be taught how to use this technology. And so the kind of toolkit that China has perfected in Xinjiang against the Uyghurs is now rolled out nationwide against Christians, is now then rolling out across particularly parts of the developing world in Asia and Africa. And sometimes this gets tied into what's called the Belt and Road program, which is a huge kind of scheme China has to offer very cheap loans and credit to build up infrastructure in poorer developing countries. But it often comes with deals. So, as you build bridges, airports, roads, China often insists that these countries that partner with them also install their technology when you build out telecoms networks or the internet. And so when you're putting in all the kind of physical infrastructure of modems and routers and stuff to build out a country in Africa, say, for example, internet, these are all, it's all Huawei kit, you know, it's Hikvision CCTV cameras and Huawei modems. And what that means is that, you know, there's no such thing as a private company. So if your data flows through in China, so if your data flows through a Huawei modem or images are being captured by a Hikvision camera, a lot of the time it means that data is effectively flowing back to data centers in China, which means you've effectively given it to the Chinese Communist Party. And so there are vast parts of the world which have effectively been stitched into this kind of techno-authoritarian surveillance state through the backbone of their internet and their communications networks now being effectively run from Beijing.
Yeah, I mean, it's remarkable, isn't it? Because I've read statistics showing that if you take the entire global population, depending on precisely how you calculate it, but something like 60 to 70% of the entire global population is now in totalitarian or authoritarian regimes. And it's a fairly small minority of the world's population that are now in genuinely democratic countries. So there is globally this growth in a kind of might is right. In other words, whoever has the power, whoever is exercising state power, has the right basically to use technology to control their population as they wish.
Hmm.
And I think this is a huge threat for Christians across the world.
And even more concerningly, it's not just explicitly authoritarian countries. You know, some of the countries that have bought into this kit are countries in Africa, for example, like Uganda or Nigeria, which are, you know, fragile democracies, flawed democracies in many cases, but they're not explicit. You know, they're not North Korea, they're not China, they're not even Russia. You know, these are countries that have a degree of kind of civil society, but it is too tempting / too hard to resist the kind of economic might of China, which says, I'll build you a bridge and for incredibly cheaply, or I'll put up your CCTV network. But the deal is we basically have access to the technology and the data, and we will induct your kind of staff into this. And I worry that actually it's not just that more of the world lives under unfree regimes, but it's that more of the free world is dipping its toe into authoritarianism because it's convenient. And there are plenty of examples I could use, even from our country, where our government has dipped its toe into digital authoritarianism because it's convenient, because people don't really understand the rights that have been taken away.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And I think this is one of those big meta issues, isn't it, about democracy and liberal, you know, classical understanding of what liberalism means versus this soft authoritarianism, which is, as you say, very attractive to governments across the world. And it does feel as though democracies are fragile, you know, not just in Africa, but in many places as well. Just changing topic slightly, I think one of the other interesting things is how much we can trust one another when within this kind of totalitarian regime, so often there are people who are effectively informers, and how that damages the possibility of trust. So that was something you came across, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. It came up actually in a case study I did. I spoke to someone from Christian Solidarity Worldwide who worked in the Americas, and she would use the example of Cuba, where they have a kind of more subtle form of persecution of Christians there, which doesn't often look like, you know, kicking the door down and dragging someone off to prison, but it's an attempt by the communist government there to kind of degrade trust within congregations and of the population in the churches. And so there was a lot of things where they would, you know, they would hack into people's Facebook accounts and post out pornography or stuff like that to try and discredit pastors, or they would set up kind of bot networks on social media and spread, again, malicious rumors about pastors that they were corrupt or having affairs or something like that. And because, paradoxically, because Cubans have not had access to the internet for very long, and it's very controlled, they're actually often apparently not very digitally literate, and so they don't have the kind of cynicism and suspicion that we have of stuff that we read online. You know, if someone posts about it on Facebook in Cuba, it means it's true, and so the authorities have taken advantage of this to impersonate pastors and set up bot accounts that muddy the waters and spread rumors and try and discredit people. And this person I spoke to, this kind of persecuted church advocate, said sometimes this has incredibly effective at basically causing kind of religious liberty defenders and dissident pastors, church leaders who are under threat from the government, to really retreat in on themselves because they feel like they can no longer trust anything they read online. They can't trust who anyone is if they are who they say they are. There's this kind of soup of disinformation and toxic stuff are out there, and the only solution as they see it is paranoia, is to fall in on yourself. And she says sometimes, you know, they won't even speak to her despite being based in America and being this kind of trusted advocate for the persecuted church, because they no longer trust each other. And this becomes incredibly corrosive, because you can't run a church, congregation, a community, certainly not one that's under pressure and threat, if you haven't got healthy interpersonal trusting relationships. And that's what's so corrosive about this form of persecution.
It certainly is. But again, I'm afraid it's not new. So I've just returned from a trip to Romania, and speaking to Christians there, in the time of the communist era in Romania, a very large number of Christians within the churches were actually co-opted by the state and became state informers secretly. And apparently they were often, it was extreme coercion. They were told that unless they agreed to become a state informer, they were going to be imprisoned or their family were going to suffer. And so there were extreme sort of pressure put on Christians to become informers. And so what it meant was that it was well known that the churches were riddled with people who were working for the communist state, and that when communism fell, there was never any kind of recognition or about who these people were. And they carried on being part of the church and apparently living Christian lives, even though there were rumors that many of them were informers and so on. And what that meant was that long after the communists had been overthrown, this atmosphere of mistrust, you never really trust anybody. You're never really honest with people. And I found, coming from outside, from the UK, that a number of church leaders and senior Christians would be honest with me about their concerns. But they said, you know, I can't speak like this to anybody in the Romanian church, because there's nobody I really trust. But because you come from the UK, I think you probably were not a communist informer.
Yeah, this is incredibly destructive, isn't it? When you can't build those kind of vulnerable relationships. You know, we've all, I hope, had that experience in church of key individuals with whom you can be totally honest and real with. And that's often where a lot of the best kind of discipleship ministry happens, in a small scale, not kind of sitting listening to a sermon, but in small prayer groups and in home groups and in that kind of thing. And if there's no one like that, then I guess my fear is that the faith remains kind of surface level and it never really goes down deep, because you can't replace that with just kind of solo Bible study.
That's absolutely right. And so trust is at the heart of Christian relationships. And there's just a step back a bit. There's some very interesting, I find interesting anyway, philosophy, theology behind all this. And that is that the Greeks, philosophers, thought a lot about truth. And it was a sort of fundamental part of Greek philosophy. But they saw it as a very abstract thing, that was something that was a sort of mathematical truth, an abstract kind of reality. And that concept of truth passed into Western philosophy, and it's still there as a mainstream part of Western philosophy. And the whole question of epistemology, how you know whether something is true or not, it's all based on this kind of rather abstract ideas. The interesting thing is that the Hebraic understanding of truth, which we find in the Bible, is really entirely related to trustworthiness. Apparently in English, the three words truth, trust, and troth, T-R-O-T-H, as in I pledge you my troth, a sort of covenantal love for the other, a commitment to the other, those three are all connected closely in fundamental meaning. And when the God of the Hebrews, Yahweh, reveals himself to Moses in Exodus, one of the words he uses five words, and one of them is the Hebrew word emet, which means literally trustworthiness. So it is God who is the ultimately trustworthy one, and all truth depends on personal relation. It depends, the way we discover truth is that truth is what a trustworthy person tells us. That is the biblical definition of truth. So if you don't know any trustworthy people, you're in trouble.
And this, what you're saying, really reminds me of that famous passage in, I think it's John 18, where Jesus is on trial before Pilate, and they have this exchange about Pilate's trying to figure out who he is. Are you a king? Are you not? You know, and Jesus ends by saying, everyone on the side of truth listens to me. And Pilate's immediate retort is kind of scoffing, what is truth? And you see the two sides of the coin there, and that Jesus says, you know, there is a truth, and it's found in a person. is found in a god who I'm the representation of. And Pilate is this kind of from the Greco-Roman world of like, you know, who are you to say what truth is? It's strikingly modern, really, though it's 2000 years old, this kind of like, you know, epistemological uncertainty and doubt and skepticism, almost postmodern in some ways. What is truth? Who is truth? And Jesus says, no, there is a truth and it's in a person.
That's right. And in fact, you know, the most cynical, as you say, is the postmoderns. And Foucault is an example of this, where he says that anyone who claims to be truthful is actually just making a claim for power. Whenever I say this is the truth, what I'm really saying is I want to have control of the levers. That's the ultimately cynical view. And of course, applied to Jesus, it means, well, that's Jesus is just making a power play. You know, Christians are just making a power play. They're claiming their truth. But what is truth? You know, ultimately, truth is an invention that we all invent our own truth.
And the most powerful repudiation of that is that this claim by Jesus to, you know, to be the true king comes in the context of where he is self-evidently not resisting himself about to be put to death. And so actually it completely undermines this idea that truth claims are all about power plays, because Jesus is emptying himself of power. He is powerless in this situation before the might of the Roman army and the zeal of the high priests. And he says, I am still the king of the Jews. I am still the Messiah. It's not going to stop you from killing me. I don't even want really to stop you from killing me. I'm going to empty myself of power, because that is the deeper truth, because that's who God is.
And I think when we apply it to ourselves, it basically, if I want to be trusted, I have to tell the truth. I have to live the truth. And of course, this is where the abuse scandals that we've had in the church are so corrosive, because when it suddenly appears that somebody who, you know, has been living in a way, when it suddenly appears that features of their life come out which are completely incompatible with the way they were claiming to live, that is so deeply corrosive, isn't it? And so I think, you know, for all of us, it's a reminder that truth is not about words. It's ultimately about how we live and whether we are trustworthy people.
And that kind of brings us neatly back round, just to finish with the kind of conclusion of the piece I wrote about digital persecution. And I was really struck by, I spoke to a guy from Open Doors, which is again a charity that kind of advocates for the persecuted church. And he said, you know, there was some common sense stuff that we should all be doing, or Christians in persecuted church should be doing, about, you know, not taking your digital devices into services and that kind of stuff. But he said, really, the fundamental heart underneath that is to go low tech, is to resist high tech persecution by going low tech. And he says, you know, this is a quote, real, genuine relationships of trust. That's what's going to make the difference of persecuted minority churches that are underground. And so it's about the first response is almost to resist the techno-authoritarianism by not allowing ourselves to live on our phones, or to replace our real world friendships with Facebook so-called friends, or to only consume church via a live stream thousands of miles away, but it's to go low tech, go back to face to face, go back to basics, and build up those trusting interpersonal relationships that will sustain your faith, particularly under times of great kind of testing and trial.
Yeah, and that's interesting. Again, it's all about the heart, isn't it? In other words, it's not about the surface appearance. It's about living from the heart, about the unseen, you know, that ultimately what makes us as people is what is unseen. But it's, of course, what God sees. So God sees the heart. God knows our hearts. God knows what our fundamental intentions are. And the challenge is to live in a way which is consistent with the way he's calling us.
And speaking of unseen things, another academic I spoke to had a fascinating idea, which is that for Christians who are concerned about the persecuted church, you know, one potential vocation or one kind of career option is to actually go into kind of professional truth telling, is to uncover the unseen things. So that might be learning how to, you know, decode algorithms that are running kind of oppressive AI software, or he said, you know, it might be going into kind of audit and accounting, so that you can go through the books of these huge international conglomerates who are sending data around the world and figure out, you know, how are they doing this and where is that money going to and what is that service is that buying? Because a lot of the problem is that our previous kind of models of persecution, the kind of lo-fi 2G, 1G versions, or as you were, persecution is based around it all being kind of localized. And so, you know, you need to write a report about how this group is burning down the houses of those Christians in that part of the world, and we send it to Parliament and our job is done. And he said, actually, a lot of this persecution now is flowing around on undersea fiber optic cables and is being facilitated in server farms everywhere. And if the church doesn't adjust to this kind of tech, high tech, AI first world, we won't be able to expose, you know, the unseen persecution, as it were, that's going on people's phones or on their laptops.
Yeah, and that makes me think of this analogy of salt and light, you know, that what light does is it penetrates into dark places. It illuminates what people want to keep hidden. And so I think the work of organizations like Transparency International, which I know actually quite a few Christians are part of that, of just illuminating, shining a bright light into places, dark places, which people want to keep hidden. That's a very Christian phenomenon. I mean, that, you know, you think of the prophets of the Old Testament, that's what they were doing. You know, they were illuminating the corruption and the false prophets and all the rest. And maybe the modern versions of that will be people doing the digital detective work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. Well, we've run out of time. Hope that was an enjoyable, interesting discussion. I certainly enjoyed digging into this topic. I'll put a link if you want to read the whole feature in the podcast description. But otherwise, thanks everyone for listening. Don't forget to check out Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. And you can always get in touch with us. We'll do another Q&A episode soon, I'm sure, of answering some questions from listeners. So do get in touch with us, emailing molad@premier.org.uk. Thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you again next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.